So here's something I probably wouldn't ask otherwise. Do you find that being a music performer, it makes it easier to speak in public?
Yes, absolutely. Because there's this different sort of energy that you have to emote, express, animate that comes with being a performer. However, when I was in the music business as a songwriter and producer, I was completely in the background. I was not interested in being in the forefront.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It was only after 9/11 that I decided, okay, I have to do these Islamic pop songs. And then I was like, oh, God, now I have to perform. I know, right?
Let me actually cut you off there because I want to get this all on. This is good stuff. So we'll get started. Welcome back to Unreasonable. We're here at the Summit for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C., hosted by Americans United. We're wrapping up a busy first day of conversations with one I've been looking forward to for a while, Ani Zonneveld. Ani is a writer, singer-songwriter, founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, which is an international human rights organization that advocates for social justice and equality for all, and a strong supporter of freedom of expression and of conscience, women's rights, and as an ally, LGBTQ rights. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, an author, serves on the UN Interagency's Faith Advisory Council, a 2023 Inspirational Woman in the LA Times, a contributor for Huffington Post, Open Democracy and Al Jazeera, and a Grammy-certified award-winning songwriter. So before we take up the whole interview space, just talking about all the awesome things you've done, thank you so much for joining us today, Ani.
Thank you for having me.
So let's actually begin there. And we started to have this conversation before we were on air because I'm so curious to know about your music career. How was it a vehicle for activism in your experience?
No, that wasn't the original plan. So I, you know, right after 9/11, I did the Islamic pop CD because I was doing music as a career, writing and producing songs. And I thought, well, I can do this in my sleep, right? So I did. And not thinking that, oops, I now have to perform. And that was actually really difficult because I liked being in the background, no makeup, just putting a cap and just being behind the mixing board and just, you know, being one of the guys. And here I had to be on stage. I had to put makeup on. I had to do my hair. And I was like, oh, God, you know, this is just not my... But that sort of made me really tune in into the way I stand, the way I speak, my presentation, clarity. So it eventually was a tool to becoming a better presenter.
And it maybe the music, as it manifested itself in your career, was an evolution of your sense for activism, your proclivity for activism.
Yes. I think the activism, I always had that. I have the heart of an activism, right? I think it just came about later in life. Yeah. I think at first it was all about doing music, these silly pop songs, you know, trying to win the awards. And the funny thing is, funny or not, but when I did win that Grammy certification, I didn't feel anything. And that was like, okay, this is weird because I'm supposed to feel elated, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because you work your butt off. And particularly when you're as an outsider, working your way into something, being a transplant. So all of that were all the different hurdles that I had to deal with, sexism, racism, you name it. Yeah. And yet when I did win that certification, I didn't feel anything. And at that moment, I knew that, you know, my life... There's something else to my life. I knew that was around the corner. I just didn't know what it was, but I just made myself available, you know, like open your heart to the universe, as they say, right? And so, yeah.
I've sometimes been self-conscious. I'm a violinist and composer in the classical music world, and I have sometimes felt that my artistic pursuits were in some way selfish and that activism was my way to give back if music was feeding my own inclinations. And I recognize that that's a dramatic oversimplification. And I've come to convince myself and been convinced by many others as well that music is absolutely a way to give back. But, you know, it is an instinct that I've had.
Well, let me also assure you that there is a spiritual saying in Islam that is, you know, music is a spiritual expression of the God in you, right? Because, so God is the most you know, I don't know if this is a secular podcast, what have you, but...
We're a couple of atheists who are very friendly to those of all persuasions.
Good. Friendly is good.
Emphasis on friendly.
Yes. No, so, for example, you know, you have God is like the most amazing creator of this world. Look at the universe, the animal kingdom, etc., the plants. And so when there's that process of ensoulment in the womb, and in Islam, it's that breath that's blown into the fetus, then becomes the human after so many 120 days, they say. That means that we are also have this the creative spirit. And so that's why radical Muslims, you know, the first thing they do is deprive you, prohibit you from doing music because it hardens the heart. When it hardens the heart, then they control you in your mind, how you think. Right? And so when you're doing music, you're staying connected to that spiritual being inside of you.
That's quite beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, and speaking of your faith, perhaps even more excited than I was to ask you a question about music, I was eager to ask you about your role as a progressive thinker within the Islamic community. We've talked to myriad Christians, some Jews, either on the air, off the air, but never a Muslim, about how much more effective a progressive thinker with faith can be an emissary within their community in ways that we could never be. You know, my wife's Christian. I talk about it on just about every show because I'm self-conscious of the fact that when I speak to Christians about non-belief, you know, I don't have that same credibility that a Christian does. Yeah. How effective do you feel you have been within Islamic communities?
In short, very. And it has been 16 years in the works, right? It took a lot of building the ground, the foundation to where I am now. The first thing that we did was to build the 10 principles of Muslims for progressive values and to justify it theologically speaking. And so to partner with scholars of Islam who are of like minds so that you have the legitimacy that the positions you take is theologically sound. Otherwise, you're just a progressive entity, you know, irrelevant to the faith. And, you know, to put it in a different context, you know, if you're going to speak to a French person, you know, it's good if you can speak French fluently, right? So it's always good to speak the language of the constituency that you're trying to sway, the constituency you're trying to come to your side. I see this all the time in the international work that I do. You have a lot of international foundations and governments putting a lot of money into secular institutions to do women and girls' rights in Muslim communities, to sway them, the parents, the religious leaders, into preaching and teaching, like girls should go to school, girls should not be forced into marriage, you know, all the stuff that, you know, is the rights that we have in the Quran. But if you're going about it in secular language, nobody's going to listen to you. You're just wasting your money. And so the effectiveness of our work, you know, the resiliency and the sway that we have is because we speak in the language of Islam. So now, for example, we have a program called Imams Fashi, and we have a network of 3,500 religious male leaders in our network who preach and teach about women and girls' rights every Friday, who have been able to change the mindset of the community so much so that women are going out and starting their own businesses and being successful. Girls are going to school and higher education. Women are participating in the political system, you know, things that were not happening 10 years ago. So that's sort of the indicator of the success of the work that we have done from that progressive thinking, writing, advocacy and sort of work. And for me, it's not good enough to have the theocracy and to have the theological basis for what we do. It's more important to actually do the work, right? How are you going to apply this to real life that affect people positively? Otherwise, you know, shut up and sit down, right?
Speak in our language.
So you're actually an imam.
Yes.
And how many female imams are there, and what is it like to do that in a male-dominated religion?
So, you know, we don't participate in the male-dominated rules of the game.
Okay.
We make our own rules because we can, because there's no prohibition against it. So the woman that really cracked the door open for us was Dr. Amina Wadud. She was an African-American theologian, and she led the first public prayer service leading men and women in prayer. And of course, there was like all hell went broke loose. So, but that was in 2005, 2006, we started. And, you know, by default, I started leading our Muslim community in prayer. Not because I chose to, but it was like, you know about Islam, go ahead and lead the prayer. And so it is a very egalitarian system. And it's actually very hard to promote an egalitarian hierarchy, like no hierarchy, because people are so wired by hierarchy and patriarchy. And so what we've done over the 16 years is to encourage everybody has a spiritual right and ownership to lead prayer, to preach, to teach, if you know the knowledge. And if you don't, then we will teach you, right? And so this is what our organization has been about. So we encourage lay leaders, right? That's how you would name it in Christian terms. So in February, I just came back from Brussels and I was invited to the first Lady Imam Conference.
Wow. I did not know there was such a thing.
Yes.
It's the first one.
Yes, the first one. And so now you have women imams, you know, like younger than me, you know, these young women that are just taking ownership. It's just amazing. And so they're from Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany, Italy, France, Switzerland. And, you know, since I've been doing this for 16 years, it was like, yeah, you got to have Ani there. So the icing on the cake was that it was organized by a foundation that was led by a Muslim straight man who was himself an imam. And so I was really touched by that, that this man really stuck his neck out to do something that was right, regardless of what repercussions he was going to get.
That's awesome. So was everybody there? Were all of the imams there under the same progressive umbrella, or were there various differences within the faith?
No, we were all, so you have to be egalitarian, inclusive, human rights framework minded, progressive to really do this, to be a progressive woman imam. And the theology is there. And it's really simple. It's like the first female imam was appointed by Prophet Muhammad himself. So why do we not have female imams? It's like, duh. It's, you know, it's patriarchy.
Yep.
And it's best. So you know, it took some digging. So the theologians, Dr. Amina Wadud, you know, she dug all this stuff up for us to learn from. And because, you know, when you go into the religious theological institutions, they teach that, but they don't practice it.
And it's almost like they only teach it to the men to tell them not to teach the women.
Yeah. They say, oh, no, only men can lead prayer, because if women lead prayer and you're praying behind the women, your prayer will not be accepted by God. It's like, really? It's
like little kid rules, playing a game.
It's
like,
so silly.
Right.
It's men playing God.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
So I'm fascinated by the fact that we're here at this summit hosted by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. And all of our minds are on white Christian nationalism and the conflation of church and state as it pertains to that particular privileged faith. Mm-hmm. What is the perspective? I mean, this is maybe a burdensome question to ask one person, but broadly speaking, at least among Islamic communities with whom you have experience, what is that perspective on church-state separation? What are the stigmas? How are they different? Particularly given the fact that Christianity is the privileged faith in this country.
Well, as a Muslim organization, I've been dealing with theocracy for a long time. And so I know theocracy when I see it a mile away. And the context of theocracy that I have been dealing with for a long time has primarily been within the Muslim majority countries, right? And how they interpret their understanding of Islam into law, into Sharia law. So to see that happening in the United States, you know, I've called it out a long time ago. I said, well, it's just no different than Muslims who interpret Islam in a particular way and then legislate it into law, the Christian legislators are doing the same thing. It's like Christian Sharia law. And I've written about this. This is like, you know, Christian Taliban, basically, right? And
vanilla ISIS.
Yeah.
Vanilla ISIS, yeah.
And so what's the difference? It's the same methodology, right? And then the audacity then to then legislate that into law for the rest of us who don't subscribe, whether you're Christian or not, whether you believe in a religion or not, to force it down our throats and like, this is the law of the land and you have to practice it. And so for me, I saw that coming a long time ago. I've written about it. And for the Muslim community, they are naive about it. But now they are aware of the methodology of how the Christian right is using Religious Freedom Restoration Act to justify discrimination in the name of Christian religion. And so the Muslim community, the Muslim right, is also learning from that same tricks and using that same tactic in order to justify discrimination in the name of Islam. And when it comes to the Christian right and the Muslim right, they're of the same ilk. They're all about quote-unquote family values. They are discriminating against LGBT rights. They're misogynistic in nature. However, in the Muslim camp, abortion is not an issue in Islam. Yeah. So we're similar to Judaism in that regard.
I had a question about that, actually, because you had mentioned earlier, I mean, just during our music conversation, that after 120 days or something, that is when...
Enslavement.
Yeah, okay. So is that related to why abortion is not the same issue in Islam?
Yeah, it's the reason why abortion is permitted in Islam. As a matter of fact, it's permitted even to the last day, to birth, because it is all hinged on the well-being of the mother. Hmm. If the mother says, no, I don't want this child, economically we can't afford it, whatever the reason is, they can abort it. Now, I don't know how they abort in those days, but yeah. So that's the leniency that we have in Islam when it comes to reproductive rights or abortion rights. It's very much hinged on the women, the mother's well-being.
You're bringing up a lot of things I've never heard before, and this concept of the Muslim right, it's fascinating to me because I would expect this group has to contend at least with the racism expressed by the Christian right and sort of give them a pass to align with some of that political ideology. I mean, at least if you mean right in terms of how they vote. I mean, maybe it's literally just, you know, conservatism. But I would think that has to be a threshold that they're either willing to ignore or accept or...
Yeah, so the Muslim right are really driven by the anti-LGBT framework. And as we've seen how they've partnered with, you know, Moms for Liberty, for example, against the, you know, progressive and inclusive public school curriculums, simply because it depicts, you know, the pride puppy or same-sex parents. But it also depicts an image of a young Muslim girl with a hijab, right? So it is inclusive because that is what our society is made up of.
Yeah.
So it's really remarkable how they have been able to really ignore or however mental gymnastics they do in order to justify being in bed with the Christian right, knowing what the Christian right has been towards Muslims. Mm-hmm. And I think probably they would, you know, more Muslims voted for Trump the second time around after the Muslim ban, right? It's crazy. So the motivation on the issue of quote-unquote family values is a real driving force.
So that's why they supported Trump in greater numbers, because he demonstrated himself as a candidate a president who would just follow the cue of his Christian handlers.
Correct.
But it can't just be that, right? Like I know when you gave your speech, you talked about General Flynn, Mike Flynn, yeah. And his... So this is... Do you feel that the right wing of the Muslim hierarchy was indoctrinated to a degree by Mike Flynn and by others to kind of grasp the misinformation that they, like, I keep thinking when you had said, you actually said, like, more Muslims voted for Trump in 2020 than in 2016. After the Muslim ban, they knew what they were voting for, mm-hmm. yet they still, in higher numbers, came out and voted for Trump. It doesn't, it can't just be LGBT issues. There's got to be, like, is it indoctrination? Is there disinfo? Was there a campaign to get Mike Flynn to convince them or sway them? I know that you had played a few videos of the one organization that, this is an international organization yeah. where it's not just happening here in the United States. Yeah. And I'd love for you to touch on that a little bit, because we think we're in this bubble here in the United States, but this is a global
phenomenon.
Yes, please. Can you tell me, because it maddens me.
Yes.
And when I heard it, my brain broke a little bit, and I'm hoping you can stitch it back together.
So they didn't have to be indoctrinated by General Flynn, because that is what they believe in, is they don't believe in the rights of LGBT people. So this is not the majority of American Muslims, mind you. It's probably like 27% of American Muslims. But these are the conservative right-wing, you know, so I have to be clear about that. The majority of American Muslims, I think over 62% support LGBT rights. So I'm talking about the religious right. However, the religious right have, like the Christian religious right, are very loud and very powerful. They're much more well organized than the progressive, the nuns, for example, right? And so the indoctrination is the religious indoctrination that each one of them all believe in the Sodom and Gomorrah, you know,
mm-hmm. yep,
Prophet Lot, the same misinterpretation, or I would say bastardization of that story.
Yeah.
And so General Flynn didn't have to do anything in order to buy there. It's for them that, oh yeah, we agree in the same set of family values, let's meet.
That's a single issue vote.
It is a single issue.
So they're only voting on one issue, despite what other aspects of a Trump presidency and how the impact of that.
Well, I mean, look at the Catholic communities and abortion, and how they could look past. We've talked about this with so many people. I can't even imagine how many conversations we've had, but how the Catholic vote around abortion could exist, could materialize, could proliferate without any concern for the fact that Trump is in every other possible way an absolute
immoral.
He is absolutely antithetical to everything that we were talking to Tim Whitaker from the New Evangelicals about it earlier today. Like this permission structure for Christians of all sorts to vote for a candidate who is clearly not a Christian himself, who clearly doesn't give a shit about faith or anything. Yeah. And in fact, probably embodies all of the deadly sins by himself.
Yep.
But so that, for that reason alone, I can wrap my head around it.
I can get it a little bit, but I'm thinking about this international movement. Like, you've talked about the 57 countries that are working to grow extremism. And we talk about just this hard right movement. And this is happening everywhere. And you're at the forefront as a woman speaking out. Trying to share progressive values. I took a look at the website for the progressive values.
MPV, Muslims for Progressive Values.
The quick facts.
Oh.
Beautiful. Everyone, if you get a chance, go to, it is Muslims for Progressive Values, and check out the Quick Learns series, because it is super cool. And it will really give you a deep dive into progressive Muslim culture, which I did not know existed.
Yeah.
And we hear so much, I guess the right has so much more money, so much more influence, but it's not just influence and money here. It's influence and money across the world.
Yeah. So you've got the OIC, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is an umbrella organization of 57 Muslim majority countries. And they vote as a bloc at the United Nations. And they espouse these very conservative values, family values. And their whole agenda is about, well, tempering or blunting the promotion and the advancement of LGBT rights within UN systems and even within their respective communities, which has really just come to a dead end in the number of discriminating laws that have been passed in many countries as of lately. And so the historical context, let me go back a little bit. You know, Malaysia used to be a British colony, and mm-hmm. so are many other countries. And the one thing that the British did was they, when they became a colonizer, they implemented a set of laws. And one of the laws was the homosexuality law. And that is, you know, if you, I can't remember the exact words, but if you partake in same-sex activity, then, you know, it's capital punishment or whatever the degree of punishment is. And those laws are still in the books, even though we have been independent of the Brits for a long time. And so it was in India, Malaysia, Pakistan, and so, you know, so many other countries, right? And so we inherited these laws. And so when I'm at the United Nations and I'm advocating for LGBT rights, for example, by way like doing a...
That's such a cool thing to say, by the way. Like, how often do you hear that? Anyway, continue.
Yeah. And, you know, educating the diplomats and educating other LGBT advocates about, you know, how we use theology in a positive way. You know, these one or two Arab diplomats will come up to me and say, oh, Ani, you know, we love the work that you do, you know, but why do you have to promote LGBT rights? You're just becoming an American tool or a Western tool, right? And then I'll say, wait. First of all, you in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, we did not have anti-LGBT laws in the books until the British colonized us. If anything, you are the one that is perpetuating puritanical Christian ideology.
I was just going to say, that's fascinating.
And so, you know, we didn't have these discriminatory laws. And so they just like, you know, they just freeze and they just like, oh, nice to see you, Ani. See you next time.
They have no response to this. They have no idea.
They're so clueless. Wow. Right? And so we have to educate not just the Muslims, but we have to educate the policymakers, the diplomats, use our tools and how we advocate for LGBT rights. You know, I'm just focusing on LGBT rights just because it's, you know, a low-hanging fruit for us, sure. You know, in this. But there's so many issues, you know, right to school for girls. I mean, there's a whole slew, FGM, female genital mutilation issues, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, so the spectrum of the work that we do, you know, the quick learns is an easy way for us, like, use our tools for whatever you're doing. So
they're beautiful. And thank you again for the work on Unchained. You actually help women get out of arranged marriages, forced marriages. Genital mutilation, which is something that isn't talked about.
Yeah.
And it happens everywhere.
Yeah.
And people, I think that they think it just doesn't happen, but
it was happening in the United States. Yes. I mean, white women were being cut in the early 20s and the early 1910s, you know, so Kellogg was a proponent of that. Mm. That's another.
That's, yep. Right. That's creepy. Well, so it's interesting that we're talking about extremism, and I'm curious about what you believe mainstream voices get wrong about Islamic extremism when they try to absolve themselves or this country or the majority religion in this country, Christianity, of resembling such extremism. You know, who do we talk to today who was talking about January 6th? If it wasn't Christian flags, but yeah, we talked to Tim as well. If this was Islamic iconography, my God, it would have been, you know, Guantanamo Bay. Like, that's it.
I would be in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So.
That's a big question.
Wow. Can you say your question again, please?
Of course. Yeah. Well, so generally speaking, what does our media outlets, political entities get wrong when they are trying to defend Christianity as being so different or extremism within Christianity?
It's a cop-out. It's so lazy. I have no kind words for this kind of reporting. It's hypocrisy. Yeah, it's hypocrisy, right? The double standards. I mean, the double standards is apparent in our mainstream media, particularly when it comes to Gaza reporting. I was like, oh God, how appalling. For us as Muslims, it's like nothing new. It's like, you know, as a progressive Muslim, it's very difficult for us to be heard in the mainstream media because they always like to go to, because what we say and how we say things don't fit their narrative of what a Muslim should sound like, right? And so I sound very American. I just so happen to be Muslim. And so, you know, that's not good enough. You know, you need to sound Muslim. Like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah, right.
Right? So it's pigeonholing.
You need to sound like the stereotype that they have perpetuated.
Exactly.
You don't have a white truck that you drive with five flags hanging from the back of it. Like the...
with an ISIS flag.
Right.
Which I call it's the vanilla ISIS, Y'al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Y'al-Qaeda. I haven't heard that in a while.
Why extremism is everywhere.
Yeah.
It grabs that religious bent. Like, you don't see a lot of...
I almost think that some folks in the media and in politics like to have the Muslim boogeyman.
Sure.
Because having the progressive Muslim voice as the mainstream representation of Islam in America, I mean, just imagine if the mainstream media went to the ultra-Orthodox Jews as representative of American Jews. I mean, the progressive Reform Jews would have a fit.
Right.
Right? So that's what American media institutions are doing to the Muslims. They're taking the most extreme voices, the most Orthodox voices, as if they represent the majority of American Muslims, and that's not true. So it's misrepresentation of American Muslims, and that does not do your readers any justice.
What do you think is the best way to break that trend?
I think to have Muslim women, progressive Muslim women, be able to have placement in op-eds. I think hell would freeze over before I would get such an opportunity in the New York Times. Fat chance. So for that really, truly progressive, different American perspective, you don't see that in these mainstream newspapers. The positions that they have had from Muslim men has been basically really not really getting to the heart of the issue. For example, like Sharia law. What is Sharia law? And the response is, well, it's a tradition. Like, no. It's 100% man-made set of law. Can you just say that?
Yeah.
You know, if you don't say, it's a cop-out.
Speaking of men, Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris.
Yes.
Like, what happened? I mean, celebrating secular life, and these men were people that were pillars of an organization, and they're like, oh, well, Christianity is okay, but Muslims are bad. Like, what in the hell, and why?
That shows you their prejudice.
And they, but how they don't see it and why it's
an embarrassment to secular humanists, you know,
to two people who consider themselves scientists.
Yes.
So I don't think they don't see it because
it's
they're too intelligent. Yes.
Wow.
They are too intelligent for that. And they are in the know. It's not like they don't have the internet and it's not like they don't have Muslim folks around them. They're choosing to be discriminating and prejudiced. So I was at an ex-Muslim conference some years ago in London, and in the audience was Richard Dawkins.
Wow, this will be interesting.
And so my presentation was about why we support ex-Muslims, the right for Muslims to become ex-Muslims. And I argue for that position from a faith perspective, from a theological perspective, because I don't want to get killed. So I argue from a theological perspective. And I shared that there's a verse in the Quran that in chapter 2, verse 244, that says there's no compulsion in faith. That means you can choose to be Muslim, to not be a Muslim, to be an atheist, to be whatever you want to believe or not. That's like in black and white, verbatim in the Quran, right? So we've been doing this work using that verse in the Quran for a good 15 years. Then the Moroccan highest religious authorities, three religious blokes, long beard, at a table, and they made the same statement that we have been advocating for. Can you believe this? And they said, there's no punishment for apostasy and blasphemy in Islam. It's been used as a political tool to silent political dissent. It has nothing to do with religion. I was like, so running with this, like, right? Because I'm a woman. I'm not a bearded Arab man. I need that to run. That was a slam dunk. So I made that case at this conference. And I got so much hate from the ex-Muslims. So Richard Dawkins was in the room. He heard me loud and clear. I speak good English. So it's all BS.
Oh, wow, that's disappointing.
Such a shame.
It's really disappointing.
Sorry to the Richard Dawkins fans, but that's the real truth.
Hey, you know.
Well, we're coming up. In fact, we probably exceeded our half hour. We're so grateful to be having this conversation with you. I wanted to close. You had you brought up something that was evocative of a conversation we had earlier today with Aaron Reed, who was talking about how the media blackout around trans issues has been inherently damaging to the trans community because people don't accept trans identity as normal. So if I heard you correctly, there is a similar blackout around Muslim perspectives.
Yep.
And we advocated at the end of our show with Aaron for listeners to reach out to local news outlets and ask, why are we not hearing these perspectives? Do you think that's a good call to action?
I think that's a great call to action. Thank you. Wonderful.
Well, Ani, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. It's been a joy to get to know you and to speak with you.
Absolutely pleasure to speak to you too. Thank you.